Atomic batteries to power, turbines to speed. Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 253, and we're going to talk about that thing that stalks you in the outdoor lands, the weather, and what you should do when that weather turns extreme. We're also going to talk about monkey magnets, just because it's a fun word. And we'll have a tale from the road about a broken sewage valve. And some advice on what to do when you put the wrong fuel in your vehicle. And that's not something to take lightly. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thank you for joining me here once again. This week's content was basically handed me, nicely wrapped in a basket, by Nelly in a can, who did a section last week. She just sent me a message and said, hey, this seems like a good idea for an episode, and she was absolutely right. She sent me a long message. I'm not going to read the whole message, but I'll read a little bit of it here. And she said that she had an event to go to in Nashville. This was a while ago, and the event was canceled because, well, the venue was under 6 feet of water, which is a very good reason to cancel something unless it's like a kayaking meetup or something. And she mixed up the weather, basically the weather report. She heard that there was a weather watch when it was actually a weather warning. The difference didn't mean anything to her. Because of that, she didn't take it as seriously as maybe she should have. And then a tornado came, and it was like 5 miles from her. And that's the time when, okay, you need to take some action. And normally when this happened, she was smart about it. She was able to take her van and park it in a parking garage, which is a great idea, or in a car wash, which is not a terrible idea, depending on a few things. But in this case, she just ended up getting stuck in traffic as everybody was trying to get out. Now, she's fine. She ended up escaping to the mountains of North Georgia, which is a beautiful place. I have been there. And she was watching the storm and, you know, watching it pass over. And she was wondering, you know, what actually is the best advice for what to do in a storm? Should you go to the mountains? Should you stay away from rivers? You know, maybe see how high above sea level you are, which, you know, could matter in some places. And she wondered if she was safer at a campsite than a parking lot. These are very good questions. So we're going to try to answer those for you as best we can in, you know, a podcast. But first, a little bit of news. Everybody who sent in a sticker request as of Monday the 7th, those stickers are in the mail to you. Again, a lot of you are international, and I have no idea how long it's going to take, but you will be getting not only a reply from me, which I haven't sent yet, but you will get, eventually, an envelope with your stickers in it. And thank you for the interest. I appreciate it. Okay, weather. One thing that all forms of van life have in common is weather. Weather is going to impact you, unless you're somehow doing van life underground, like in an abandoned salt mine or something. You're going to be out in the weather. And it's one of the things that folks living in houses and condos have to worry less about than folks living in vans and trailers and school buses and whatever your situation is. The weather can seriously impact you and actually be dangerous. So there are a few steps you should take, and you should take different steps at different times depending on things. So the very first step you should take is awareness. Just like Nelly was talking about, being aware of the weather, of course, is a super important thing. Being forewarned is being forearmed. And that's F-O-R-E, not F-O-U-R. It's a little weird imagery there. But yes, being forearmed means that you're prepared, right? So you have to be aware in order to be prepared. And when I get down to the resource recommendation, Nelly again also recommended a great app for staying aware, but it is important to understand what you're looking at. The weather reports, they're great, they're nice and everything, but you actually have to know what they're talking about to some extent, and to sort out the difference between a watch and a warning. It's unfortunate that they both begin with the same letters, because it's easy to, like, well, it's just a warning. Like, if I get a warning instead of a speeding ticket, that's not a big deal. And a watch is like, you're just looking out for something? I mean, well, I'm going to tell you what they are right now, and it's important that you understand the difference. A watch, whether it's a tornado watch or any other kind of watch, means that there is a higher than average chance of this event occurring in your area. So if you hear there's a tornado watch, that is a reminder to pay more attention to the weather today. That doesn't mean you have to take immediate action. If you have a lot of things outside that could blow away, you might want to think about securing them just to be safe. But it doesn't mean that there's a tornado imminent or anything like that. It just means that you have a higher than average chance of encountering a tornado today, or for whatever the watch period is. They will give you times, and those will change a lot, by the way. So if they say, you know, tornado watch ends at 6 p.m., that's what they're guessing then. That can move. And what I have at home here in Chicago, which, believe it or not, is susceptible to tornadoes, Alexa will actually tell us. And it will give us a notification saying, you know, hey, you've got a tornado watch. And then every time it changes, it'll tell us again, the tornado watch has been extended. Okay? Anyway, that's what a watch is. A warning is, that's time to take action. When you hear warning, that means you have a very elevated chance of encountering a tornado. A warning usually means that a tornado has been seen. There's an actual tornado in your area. Now, the ability to predict where a tornado is going to go is not very accurate. Tornadoes are strange things. They have minds of their own. Having worked with Team Rubicon and disaster sites, I've seen what they can do. They'll go down a street, completely destroy a house, skip a house and leave it pristine, and then destroy the next three houses, or they will jump to the next street, or they'll just suddenly disappear. They are unpredictable things, and you need to treat them that way. So therefore, when you hear the word warning, tornado warning, take action immediately. I don't care if you're watching a movie or cooking dinner or whatever you're doing, you should act as though the tornado is coming right at you. That is the safest thing to do. The problem is that they have to be overcautious with these warnings. And if you've lived through a few of them, for example, if you live in the Midwest of the United States, you have probably lived through a few tornado warnings, and you have probably never seen a tornado. So you get this attitude like, oh, whatever, they always say that. Well, they say that because for those people that are absolutely in the path of a tornado, it's devastating. Of all the weather in the world, tornadoes are the one that is the scariest to me because you get very little warning. Hurricanes, you know they're coming days ahead of time. Lightning, okay, yeah, that's another thing we'll talk about in a minute. That is something you're worried about. Like snowstorms, blizzards, you know they're coming. Rain, you know it's coming. Really cold weather, you know it's coming. A tornado can come on a day where it's sunny and beautiful at noon, and then you don't have a house anymore at 2 o'clock. Tornadoes are really frightening, and that's why you do need to take these warnings seriously, even though you may have lived through several and never seen a tornado. They're a good thing to be paying attention to. Let's say you're at a campsite and you're set up, you got your chairs out and stuff. When you hear tornado warning, you should immediately secure everything in the area. Put everything away, get ready to move. Make it so you can move your vehicle. If for any reason you think the tornado is very close, like you start hearing tornado sirens, that's different than a warning. Tornado sirens are, holy cow, here it comes. Again, living in Chicago, I've heard the tornado sirens many times. I've never seen a tornado. But that doesn't matter. You have to take it seriously. So taking it seriously means getting out of the way of the tornado. But we have to be very careful about that. It depends on how much time you have, and figuring that out is tricky. Usually, by the time you hear the sirens, you don't have enough time to drive away. You can't outrun a tornado. You can't. You as fast as you drive in your van, the tornado can go faster. Plus, the tornado doesn't care about roads. You're fairly limited to staying on the pavement in most cases, and the tornado doesn't care. It'll cross the lake, it'll go across someone's field, and you don't know where it's going to go. You just cannot predict its path. So, you have to do something else. The van is not a safe place to be in the tornado. Not only can the tornado pick up your van and just toss it somewhere, it can also throw things through it. There are many pictures online, and they're well worth looking up, of what a 2x4 can do in a tornado. It will go right through your van, right through your driver's seat, through your bulkhead, and potentially through you. The stuff I saw in post-tornado areas was amazing. I saw an aluminum downspout, you know, really thin metal that you use for gutters on a house, jammed into an oak tree, inches deep. The force that must have taken, I can't even imagine. And that could be you. If it goes through an oak tree, it's gonna definitely go through you. So that's why your van isn't safe. And that's why driving away isn't safe. Because if it catches up to you, you're in serious trouble. So you need to go somewhere safe. Where is safe? Well, hopefully you have scoped that out ahead of time. If you're in a tornado area, you need to look around and see, okay, if a tornado comes, where am I going to go? If you're in a campground, for example, they will probably have a designated tornado shelter, and a lot of times it will be the shower house or the toilet house or whatever they have. A concrete block building. That's a pretty safe place. If you're somewhere with a parking garage or other concrete structure, that's going to be good. If you're in an airport, like DFW has a huge tornado shelter, it's the bathrooms in the center of the airport. Stairwells also tend to be safer than any other part of the building. All of those places are good. Low is better than high. But what if you're in, say, Kansas, and you're in a campground, and you can see the horizon 360 degrees around, and there's really no structure? What do you do then? Well, if you're caught outside and a tornado is coming, the best thing you can do is get as low as possible. Find a ditch, a culvert, anything like that, and get in there. I don't care if it's wet. I don't care if it's water. We're trying to save your life at this point. Get in there, cover your head with your arms, and hope for the best. That's the best you could do. That is better than being in your van. Because remember, it's not just getting sucked up in the tornado that's the problem, it's all the flying debris. And if you're in, say, a drainage ditch, as unpleasant as that might be, the debris is going to be much less likely to hit you. So let's say you're in your van and the tornado's coming right at you. For whatever reason, you are in your van, the tornado is so close that leaving the van actually would be more dangerous because you'd never make it anywhere else. This is not an ideal situation to be in. You should do a lot of things to avoid being in this situation. But if you are in this situation, maybe you're just driving along and you're cranking out the tunes and holy cow, there's a tornado right in front of you. Yeah, that can happen. This is what you should do. Immediately pull over. Do not go under an overpass. This is a common thing you see in movies all the time. The latest Superman movie, I think Superman's father dies because everybody goes under an overpass and he can't make it. That's a myth. You do not want to go under overpasses because what happens is that overpass creates a Venturi effect and the wind forces under the overpass are actually stronger than they are outside. You will get sucked out. So that's not safe. In this weird case that you don't want to be in, pull over, stay in your van, just park on the side of the road. If there's somewhere low you can get, I mean, driving your van into a drainage ditch is not a terrible idea in this circumstance. It might be better. Do not turn off the van. You can turn off the engine, that's fine, but leave the van in the on position because that'll make the airbags stay active and you may need them. And then you want to get your head below the level of the glass any way you can. If you're in a passenger seat and you can fold over, you know, just bend over, that's fine. If you're in the driver's seat and you can, like, kind of roll over to your right or left, depending on where you are, that's fine too. But you want to cover your head with your arms and blankets or whatever else you have and try to stay below the glass because likely your van is going to get hit with all that debris. Your glass is going to break. And when those first impacts hit the van, the first big one, that's going to make your airbags pop, and then you'll be in this bubble of airbags. But remember, that doesn't last forever. Those airbags deflate immediately. Keep your seatbelt buckled in case your van does move. You're going to be in an accident. It's just like being in a car accident. So you want to do all the things you would wish you could do if there was a car accident. That's your best chance, but your chance isn't good. Really, your best thing is awareness. Stay aware, pay attention to these warnings. Whenever you hear a tornado watch, take some time to look at the map and see what region the watch is for. If you're traveling and you have the option, it might be a good idea to leave that area. Whenever you hear warning, you need an immediate plan. You need an immediate plan for what you're going to do to be safe. And then once you see a funnel cloud or you have reason to believe it's very close, then you're doing serious action. Nothing else at that point should be done except saving yourself from the tornado. That's the mentality you have to have. And when it's all over, everything's fine, you go back to the awareness stage. Well, that's a tornado. There's other weather you have to worry about too. What about flooding? Well, flooding, you generally would have a lot of warning about. We understand that, hey, rain falls, and then it goes here, and then it floods. And it can be very quick. The weather reports will warn you of flood. You can look at flood maps online. For example, if you have a campground you're staying at, and there's a flood warning, hopefully the people running the campground would know what to do and tell you. But in case they don't, or let's say you're in BLM land, and there's no one to tell you, you can actually look at the floodplains online. You can just Google where you are, flood map, and it will show you. And you can see, this area floods every year, or this area hasn't flooded for 25 years, or whatever, and you can make your decision based on that. But obviously, if you know an area is going to flood, get the heck out of there and get somewhere higher. I mean, and do it sooner rather than later, because as Nelly ran into, traffic's going to build up and be crazy. All right, last one I'm going to mention, because obviously we could talk all day about what to do in a hurricane, what to do in a blizzard, all that stuff that you have a lot of warning for. Obviously, get the heck out of there. But one thing you don't have a lot of warning for are thunderstorms related to tornadoes, but a whole lot more common, and then lightning. Lightning is pretty dangerous if it hits you. I mean, not a lot of people survive a direct lightning strike. So if you have an app on your phone that warns you if there are lightning strikes in the area, or you see lightning or whatever, obviously first thing you're going to do is get the heck out of any water you're swimming in. That's pretty obvious. But the second thing you're going to do is go inside your van, because your van is pretty good at protecting you from lightning. Your van, depending on its construction, is made out of metal. You're in a cage. In this case, we could refer to that as a Faraday cage. It's not a perfect Faraday cage, but when lightning hits your vehicle, it's not going to go inside the vehicle. It's going to run over the skin of your vehicle, eventually going through the tires into the ground. But wait, tires are made of rubber. Rubber is an insulator. Therefore, the rubber is going... No, actually, at that amount of power, at the voltage that lightning is, which is crazy voltage, it's a lot of voltage, it doesn't care about the insulating power of your tires, especially if they're wet. It's just going to go right through your tires into the ground. So the tires don't play a big role here. It's the metal cage of your van or any vehicle. Now, if you're in an RV that is maybe home-built out of plywood, or fiberglass even, you may have less protection. But even a fiberglass RV typically will have metal framing. Not always, but that metal framing will keep you protected. At any rate, you're going to be safer in there than you are outside. So that's a good thing. If your vehicle is hit by lightning, chances are you and the vehicle are going to be fine. But if you stay outside, that may not be true. Most important thing I told you of all of this is awareness. Stay aware of your situation. Take some time to be prepared and have a plan for what to do, and you'll be fine. And it can actually be kind of fun. I don't know about tornadoes, but watching a lightning storm from inside the van, I'm good with that. That's fun. Special thanks to Kay and Michael. Thank you so much for your support at buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. Thank you for the diesel, and thank you for making it so we don't have any ads. Thank you so much for that. If you would like to help keep ads off of this podcast, please visit buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And you will help support this program, and none of us will have to listen to ads, and we will thank you. And as always, thank you very much to the folks who donate every month. You are my favorites. Van Life News. Every single thing I thought to talk about with Van Life News had that T word, you know, that T word that is tariff, but is tax. I get nothing to say. You know I have nothing to say. So we're just going to move on into some other news. All of this news is much less important, and it will impact your van life a lot less. But at least it's something different that I can actually share with you that might be useful, because I've got not a lot to say about the other stuff. So first thing that caught my attention was PA, Pennsylvania, promotes state parks amid federal campground closures. See, they're starting to get smart. So the federal campgrounds in the United States are kind of in upheaval. They laid off a bunch of staff, or they unhired staff in many cases, and then some of the campgrounds, like at Yosemite, for example, put off reservations. They're like, geez, we're not even going to open these campgrounds this year. And then someone in the government said, no, you must open those campgrounds, without actually fixing the staffing. I have no idea. I'm going to stick with what I said before, is that this is a really good year not to go to the national parks, especially if you plan on camping there, because it's really unpredictable. And if you do plan on going to one of them, have a plan B. But the state parks, which are often the best places for camping, especially in a converted van, because they're nowhere near as restrictive, are starting to catch on that, maybe we can drum up some business for folks. And so Pennsylvania's jumped on that bandwagon. And yeah, that's great. I think state parks are an underlooked resource in the U.S. And yeah, some of them are raising prices, and they've got all the same problems the federal government has. But they're definitely something to consider, and they aren't necessarily on folks' radar when they go into a place. You know, you've traveled across the country, and you're looking for campgrounds. And if you just Google campgrounds, you're probably going to get mostly commercial camp. Take a look at state parks. So this article here about New Hope is basically Pennsylvania saying, hey, we've got some great state parks. Come visit. And I have stayed in Pennsylvania state parks, and I agree. They tend to be affordable. You tend to have a lot more space in your campground than you would at a commercial campground. And there's a lot more wilderness orientation rather than, you know, water parks and all that stuff. You don't get that stuff. You just get a safe place to park in the woods with some services. You're less likely to get full hookups, but again, most of us are pretty self-contained and that's not an issue. So check out this article. It's in the New Hope Free Press, and it talks about what Pennsylvania has to offer. But remember, all states have state parks. That is an option. I also noticed this article from culture.org talking about digital nomad destinations in 2025. So digital nomads are folks that are not tied to a location for their job. And they're called digital because they typically work on computers, and they can live anywhere they want to do their jobs. And probably 10, 15 years ago now, some countries thought about this and were like, this would be an interesting way to get people into our country who could, you know, help support our economy. And they created these special visa programs for digital nomads that would make it very easy for anybody to had a job that was remote to just go live in that country for a while. New Zealand, for example, just reduced their requirements. So if you wanted to go to New Zealand for a while, now's a great time. Typically, the visas last for a year or 3 years, and they're renewable, but they're not typically a path to citizenship. These are for folks who are going to go stay in a place for a while and then move on. Culture.org has revamped their list for 2025 because things change, living costs change, places that were good are no longer good, etc. So if you're thinking, hey, maybe that's the lifestyle you want, and sure, you can do van life in other countries. You can be a digital nomad and have a van in New Zealand or in Malta. That might be a little weird. Or, you know, Germany. I don't know. Wherever you want to do. It's not a bad idea to be aware of these things. So you can give that article a look. Again, it was in culture.org. And this last bit of news, well, I have to present it because it's a bit of a warning. Nobody can predict the future. Things are definitely in turmoil, especially in the U.S. right now. However, all the trends I see in the news, and I was looking for something positive, but I couldn't find it, are that temporary hiring is going away. There just isn't any. Everybody, all these companies in the face of this uncertainty are freezing hiring, and a lot of the normal temporary jobs and paid internships and things like that are being canceled. That's going to put pressure on the temporary job market, and that could affect people in van life, as there's going to be more people out there looking for those seasonal jobs. And don't forget, we're not at Christmas yet, right? While there's always a lot of seasonal jobs in November and December, in the summer there often are too, but a lot of those don't exist anymore. All those jobs that used to exist at national parks and campgrounds and at firms that used to have paid internships, that stuff is really going to be hard to find this summer. So I don't actually have an article to link you to. Just search. I was searching news for something like, hey, there's got to be some sector here that's hiring more, and maybe the van life folks can take advantage of that. And yeah, I couldn't find one. Instead, I found all kinds of articles talking about how companies are not doing that this year. So we could be in for a rough ride. And if you're seeking employment, you might have to look a little bit harder. Again, forewarned is forearmed, and I don't like having to give bad news. But as of right now, in April, it looks like jobs are going to be pretty hard to find this summer. And if you're someone who was just about to set out in van life and was hoping to do, you know, the beet harvest and all that kind of seasonal work that's typical for van lifers, well, you might not be able to count on it. And again, I'll talk about the tariffs very briefly. Yes, a tariff is a tax, and these taxes are going both ways. And one way that's really impacting this is that American farmers export a lot of stuff, and now they can't. They export a lot of food, and that is no longer feasible. And they don't have any place to put the food. I mean, they can't sell it in the U.S. market because it's just way too much food for the U.S. market to absorb. And they can't sell it overseas because of the tariffs, so they're not going to grow it. And if they don't grow it, it doesn't need to be harvested. And if it doesn't need to be harvested, they don't need you. So word to the wise, this is an excellent time to start keeping your finances in focus and make sure you have some sort of employment. And boy, I wish I could tell you where to look. I will keep looking, but you definitely should. Tech Talk. So, this has happened to a lot of people, and it's especially likely to happen if you travel, say, in Mexico from the U.S., or if you're going to BP, the gas station that destroyed the color coding for handles on gas pumps. You see, it used to be that gas pump handles had a bit of a code. It wasn't ever firm, but typically a green gas pump, or a green handle on the nozzle, meant that it was diesel. And then BP, whose color is green, decided to make all their handles green, and the diesel ones are black. So the chances of you putting the wrong fuel in your tank are fairly high. Now, there are different nozzle sizes, and it's hard to actually get diesel into a gasoline neck. Some of you are probably too young to know this, but back when the country was shifting from leaded gasoline to non-leaded gasoline, they actually put a fuel neck restrictor on so that leaded gasoline nozzles, which were bigger, wouldn't fit into unleaded gasoline tanks because there was a smaller hole, which means that now that we've moved past that phase, we're all stuck with smaller nozzles that takes more time to pump gas. Anyway, in most cases, diesel will not fit into your gasoline car. But in Mexico, that's not necessarily true. They don't really obey this, and sometimes they use the smaller nozzles too. So first thing is make sure you know what fuel you're putting in your vehicle. And if somebody else is pumping the fuel, make sure they know too, because I've heard a few stories of folks in Mexico assuming that all vans use diesel, because down there, that's actually the way it is. But American vans typically will use gasoline, especially if it's a Transit or a Promaster. Anyway, you can see the problem. So, it happens. Sometimes the wrong fuel gets in the tank. So, what do you do? First, you stop. You do not start the engine. You do not want the wrong fuel to flow through your engine, whether it be diesel in a gasoline engine or gasoline in a diesel engine. It is bad. They are not the same thing. They're not different versions of the same things. They're completely different ways of processing fuel for power. They're not compatible. Leaded gasoline, unleaded gasoline, yeah, you could play some games there, but diesel and gasoline are just completely different. Gasoline explodes in your engine, literally. Diesel kind of expands. It's very different. Also, diesel is a lubricant. Diesel is an oil. It is a lubricant, and your engine counts on that. If you have a diesel engine, it lubricates itself in some ways with the diesel fuel. Gasoline is a solvent. It will actually go through there and remove any lubrication and cause parts like your fuel pump to fail very, very quickly. If diesel gets into a gasoline engine, it's going to foul everything up. It's like putting an oil in there, because guess what? It is. And your fuel pump isn't going to be able to pump it properly. It's going to gum everything up. In both cases, it's a very, very expensive repair. So if this happens, you stop. Don't start the engine, and you're going to have to drain your tank. Ugh, it's horrible. And you're going to have to get help. I mean, you're going to have to tow the vehicle somewhere where they can safely drain the tank and dispose of however many gallons of gas-a-diesel or dieseline or whatever the heck you've created. If you're lucky, you'll find a mechanic who can actually use that in a heater or something, or some really old engine that's not so picky. But yeah, that's your situation. Now, what if you stick the nozzle in and you pump a little bit and you're like, oh no, it's the wrong fuel, and you stop? This gets a little bit more complicated. So the official line is the same. Any level of gasoline and any level of diesel in the tank is going to be a problem. You need to drain the tank. However, I'm just giving you information here. I'm not telling you what to do. A lot of the old mechanics will say a little bit is okay in either direction, but you have different problems. So if you get a little bit of diesel into your gasoline tank, your problem is that you've basically got dirty gasoline and it's going to foul things up. So you need to dilute that as much as possible. And if you're in that situation and you can't drain the tank for whatever reason, make sure you stop and get gas every 20 miles, 30 miles, whatever increment you can make work. You want to basically burn a gallon and add a gallon of fresh gas. Burn a gallon, add a gallon of fresh gas. That's going to be your best bet for preventing any damage. And then, next time you're doing any maintenance, replace the fuel filter or fuel filters, because they're going to collect a lot of crap from the diesel. It may work. It may not. You may cause permanent damage to your engine, but the old mechanics say that's something that you can get away with. And of course, you're going to have more luck with this in an older vehicle than a new one, because the new ones are much more sensitive. On the other side of things, if you get a little bit of gasoline into your diesel fuel, you have basically removed lubrication from your diesel. That's the big concern. And it's the same thing. Drive a little, replace it with fresh diesel, drive a little, replace it with fresh diesel, and so on. And there are folks saying that you can add things to help mitigate this, like Marvel Mystery Oil and Seafoam and things like that. And I don't know. I mean, I think if I did this and I got like a little tiny bit of gasoline in my diesel, I would probably buy some diesel treatment and add it and go with that. And it might cost me. I don't know. My diesel's a 2011 and it's new enough to have all the DEF stuff, but it's old enough that maybe it would be okay. I don't know. At any rate, make sure you're putting the right fuel in, and make sure if anybody else is fueling your vehicle, they're putting the right fuel in. You can't trust the nozzle sizes or the color of the things. You actually have to look and see that this says diesel or it says gasoline. And even if you do that, sometimes the people filling up the tanks at the gas station can screw up and put stuff in the wrong place. And the only way you're going to notice that is by smell. If you're pumping diesel and it smells like gasoline, you have a problem, and vice versa. Fortunately, the two things have very distinctive smells. You should be able to tell the difference. And if you smell the wrong one, stop and figure out why. Maybe somebody's pumping next to you and that explains it. Or maybe the wrong fuel is in there. And if that's the case, go inside and say, I'm concerned I have the wrong fuel. It's not a situation you want to get yourself into. But hopefully that explains what's going on and you'll be able to avoid it. Product review. Let's talk about monkey magnets. I would like to be the spokesperson for monkey magnets just because it's so much fun to say. This is an as-seen-on-TV product, and, well, you know how those are. But it's kind of interesting for van life. These are little metal plates. They're about the size of a quarter if I got run over by a train. You can imagine that. There's got to be a better measurement than that. Because being from the U.S., I can't possibly use anything like centimeters or millimeters. I have to come up with something else. Let's say a small Band-Aid. No, that's not going to do it. A stick of Trident? No, they're a little bit wider than that. They're thinner than SD cards. Well, okay, I give up. They're 1.75 by 1.62 inches. Oh, you want real units? Okay. So they're 4.5 centimeters by 4 centimeters, okay? Does that help? I don't know. I feel like I need a fruit or something. But all right. So you may have seen these things on TV. They're just these little metal plates that are magnetic. And the idea is that you use them to close doors or whatever you need for that. And they're supposed to be super strong. And back when I had my surgery, I bought some thinking that while I was laid up, I could actually test them properly. And of course, then I got drugged out of my mind and everything. But now that I'm getting more mobile, I have had a chance to play with them. Now, I have not used these in any of my rigs because of the way my rigs are. My ambulance does not have cabinets that have doors. It has sliders, which if you think about an ambulance, that makes a lot of sense. You need very quick access. You don't want anyone to bump their head and you don't want things to possibly open. So these sliding doors are a great solution for that. But if you have what most people have is an overhead door that kind of opens to the top, the latch is a problem for DIYers. The best latches are the positive latches, the ones that actually lock in place, but they require a level of precision installation that I am personally not comfortable with, and I know a lot of other people aren't. So magnets are appealing, but are they strong enough to actually use? Now, I can tell you from experience that the IKEA cabinets that come with magnetic closures are not anywhere near strong enough. They will not hold your stuff in. If you go around a corner, that door's opening and everything is ejecting itself into your van. So if you have IKEA cabinets with doors, you're going to have to come up with another solution. Are monkey magnets that solution? Well, maybe, and I wish I could give you a more definitive answer, but they are pretty strong, and what's really nice about them is that they come with pre-drilled recessed holes. It would be easy to install these and have a nice clean installation. If you use the right kind of screw, you know, the kinds that look like the head looks like a pyramid, like a normal wood screw kind of a screw for recessed holes, they're made for this, you will have a flat metal plate on both sides and they will meet together. And it'll be noisy. There's two pieces of metal hitting each other. But it should be pretty strong. And I think for some applications in a van, this could work very well. It could also work if you wanted to do something like hang things up on a magnetic bar that weren't magnetic. For example, if you had, oh, this is a crazy example. You know how there are those magnetic bars that people put knives on? Well, what if you wanted to put wooden spoons on there? You could attach these plates to wooden spoons and hang them up there. And I think that would work just fine. I don't know why you would want to do that, but hopefully it creates the mental image that I'm trying to create for you here, is that these things, if you can screw them into something, will make them magnetic. Both sides are magnetic, both neodymium, they're both very, very strong, but I don't think they're going to hold, say, pots and pans in. If you go around a corner and those pots and pans hit the door, I think they're just going to push the door open with almost any kind of magnets. I don't think they're that strong. By the way, side note, one way to prevent that is to put pressure rods in your cabinets so that anything that's about to slide out is going to hit the pressure rod first and not hit the door. That can help a lot. Here's my advice though with these, and I have a link in the show notes, of course. They're 10 bucks. You get 8 pairs for 10 bucks. They come with 3M tape, which is a good sign. It's not cheap tape. They actually spent the money to get the official 3M tape and put it in there. And the idea is that you can tape them up. Well, you can do that and try it. If you don't like it, you can just remove it. 3M tape isn't that hard to remove if you do it quickly, but it can be a pain to remove if you wait. And that way you don't have to drill any holes. Or you can just go ahead and drill the holes. But what I'm suggesting is that you buy some and try them out for yourself and see if they work for your situation. It's a $10 risk. And I'll bet you can find something to use them for, even if they're not going to be any good for like keeping your cabinets closed. Because honestly, you can use these for almost anything. You could sew them into fabric and use them to hold up coverings or keep curtains closed or whatever. The advantage of these things is that they are magnets with holes in them. That's what's cool about these. And the holes are in steel, not in the magnet itself. Neodymium magnets are fragile. And while you can buy donut-shaped neodymium magnets, they can break very, very easily. These things won't break. They're just like little pieces of steel. And that might give you some ideas for how to use them. So, hey, 10 bucks. If you're building out a van and you're looking for some ideas, go ahead and pick some up. They're not terrible. They're not going to solve every problem you have in the van, but they're just another thing to put in your quiver. And, I don't know, some of our quivers are getting pretty full. But anyway, buy more. Forget minimalism. Just get more stuff. Tales from the Road. This is a tale about psychology. I kind of think they all are, but this one is very specific, and I remember it very, very well. When I was 21, I did something very foolish. I did something that, in retrospect, seems very foolish to me, but I bought a camper. Yes, here I am, the van life guy telling you that I was foolish to buy a camper. It was one of those Toyota, it was actually a Toyota Mini Cruiser. It was a little Toyota pickup truck with a camper built onto it. Technically a Class C, but they were pretty much referred to as micro Class Cs. If you've watched FNA Van Life, they had a similar one that they named Sunny. It was a Sun Raider, much bigger than mine, actually. But it was pretty cool. I mean, it had the Toyota front, which was super reliable. It had that really good 22R engine, and it was manual transmission too, which in some cases is good. And in the back, it was fully contained. It had a big queen-size bed that went over the cab, and then it had the typical dinette that also became a bed. It had a stove and an oven and a vent and a three-way refrigerator and a bathroom and a shower and a holding tank. I mean, it was a tiny, fully self-contained rig. And I think if they still made these things, they'd sell them like crazy because you could do anything you wanted in this thing. And I loved it, but boy, was it dumb. It was a dumb thing to buy because I bought it on credit and it was an enormous car payment and it was going to last forever. And I knew that buying this thing, that it was going to have to provide like all my entertainment and be like kind of the focus of my life because it was costing so much money. And I was fine with that. It was my daily driver too. So I drove it around and I would sleep in it whenever I wanted. I many, many times, whatever job I had at the time, I'd go out in there at lunch. And I remember watching I Love Lucy on a black and white TV while cooking a can of soup in the desert of Utah on a lunch break once. I mean, that's a memory that's seared in there forever. But I loved this thing. I really enjoyed having it. And I learned a lot, and I spent a lot of time, you know, making modifications that I wanted to, and I learned things that were good, and I did some things that were bad, and well, that's how it is. When you have your first rig, you're gonna do things that are dumb, and I'm not gonna get into those right now. But the thing that bothered me the most of all the things I did was I hit a curb with the holding tank valve. Now, backing up a step here, this thing had a holding tank, but it was one holding tank. It was a combined black water and gray water tank. Very small. If you took a shower, you basically were going to fill this thing up, and you had to empty it immediately, which caused some hilarious incidents. Not ideal, but better than not having it, right? So I was happy to have it, but when I ripped off that valve, I couldn't empty it. Basically, if you know what a holding tank valve looks like, it's the round part that the hose attaches to, and then the handle sticks out. There's like a plastic rectangle that sticks out, and then the handle comes off of that. I broke off that whole rectangle. All that was left was the part that the hose connected to, and there was no way to open the tank. And that part was cemented in to the tank. So to repair that, not only would I have to find a way to empty the tank, I would then have to do plastic welding or plastic cement, and I had read that this was not normal ABS cement you had to use. It was something special. So I was really angry. I had spent all this money and time on this thing, and I had ruined it by ripping this part off. And I was just in despair. You know, I was like, even if I work hard and make money and buy this really nice thing that I wanted, I'm still going to ruin it. And I was angry. And I went inside and I looked, and there was stuff laying around. I hadn't really been keeping up on the housekeeping. The bed wasn't made, and there were some dishes in the sink. And I was just like, this is not a state I want to live in. I don't want things to be like this. And though I felt like just walking away from everything, what I ended up doing was like, all right, let's take this step by step. This is a problem. This needs to be fixed. There's stuff that you don't know how to fix yet, but there's stuff you do know how to fix. For example, you know how to do the dishes. You know how to make the bed. And so I spent a couple of hours inside the camper going through everything, putting everything away, making sure everything was tidy and where it was supposed to be, and making it actually look nice. And after I was done, I remember I sat down in the chair and I looked around and said, you know what? This thing's pretty cool. I am really fortunate to have something like this. And that whole big problem with the holding tank suddenly became a little problem. It was just this one little thing that was wrong with this rig that I absolutely loved. And so I worked the problem. And working the problem to me is you take the problem and you cut it into as many pieces as you can. And I did, and I looked at it, and I was like, okay, well, that rectangle thing with the handle had to connect to something, and oh, sure enough, there's a piece of plastic that slides in and out of the valve, and I broke that off, but I might be able to get some needle-nose pliers in there and pull on that piece of plastic. And I did, and I was able to empty the tank, which fortunately was just gray water, and then I looked, and I was like, wait, I don't actually have to do any welding or anything. This valve part actually bolts on. I can unbolt it and put on a new one. And I was like, oh, where am I going to get that? And so on and so forth. And this was way before Amazon or anything like that. So the next day, I went to an RV dealer who had a parts store. And I said, you know, I don't know if you're going to have this part, but I broke off the valve for my holding tank. And the guy was like, oh, yeah, aisle three, row A. And I go over there, and there's this big bin of these things, because apparently this happens all the time. What I had done was not an unusual thing. A lot of RVers have encountered this in one form or another. Sometimes the things just break in your hand. And yeah, it was four bolts. I took the old one off, I put the new one on with four bolts, and boom! My rig was back to perfect again, or pretty close to perfect. And it was all about psychology. I made a mistake. I did something bad. That is going to happen. In all of your rigs out there, everybody listening, at some point you're going to do something stupid. And you're going to break something. And it's going to make you angry. But it's important to be able to take a step back and realize, no. Not everything's ruined here. Just this one thing. And this one thing is fixable. It doesn't take away from anything else. And you work on that, and you fix it, and then it just becomes a story you can tell on a podcast, you know, 40 years later. A place to visit. It's Iceland. That's the place. You should visit Iceland. And here's the very interesting thing about Iceland. It's the only place I know of that has a booming market in camper van rentals. I mean, it's actually a major thing there. It is completely normal to fly to Iceland, which isn't as hard as you might think. Iceland Air is a pretty decent airline, and Iceland isn't that far away. I mean, think about it. It's like halfway to Europe. You know how far away Europe is? Well, it's half that. You go to the airport, and then you get in a camper van, and you drive around the country. That's a completely normal, supported thing. Nobody's going to look twice at you. You're going to see a dozen or two dozen other people doing the same thing, and I don't know any place else in the world that's like that. And for some reason today, it just occurred to me for the first time that if you're somebody who would like to try out van life, go to Iceland and try it. They'll give you instructions. They give you the rigs. The rigs are simplified. They're meant to be rentals, so you don't have to worry about super complex stuff. They're actually going to be pretty simple. They tend to be small, so if you're worried about driving a big vehicle, you can absolutely get a small van. And, you know, try it out, and then if halfway through you hate it, turn it in, get a rental car and a hotel, and enjoy your trip in Iceland. Iceland can be an expensive place to go to, but it's not that bad. And heck, if you've got a camper van, your hotel and rental are combined, and you can cook some of your own meals and save money. Now, I'm not going to recommend a company for you because there are so many, and you can just search Iceland camper van and find dozens of them. Why not? I mean, what better way could there be for you to see if you like van life or not? So that's my new recommendation for everybody who wants to see if they like van life. Go to Iceland! Yes, I understand not everybody can afford that, etc. But their rental prices for camper vans are, from what I've seen, better than what you can get on Outdoorsy or whatever in the US. So if you've always wanted to see Iceland and you've always wanted to try a camper van, well, heck, you can do both at once. Resource recommendation. Pursuant to our discussion of weather earlier, Nelly also introduced me to this very cool app called Ventusky. Okay, it's probably called Ventusky. I'm going to call it Ventusky just because it's fun. It's Ventusky, so Ventusky. How they pronounce it, I don't know. I'm in Camp Jif, by the way, if we want to get into that discussion. Anyway, this is a very cool website and app, and it reminds me of Windy, if you remember that app, combined with Dark Sky. If you could combine those two, you would get Ventuski. And I think everybody who has a smartphone or a way to get on the web needs to check out Ventuski.com. It is one of the best, it is the best weather app I have ever seen. Now, they have a free version, and they have two levels of paid version. The free version is all you need, folks. Chances you're going to need the paid version are very slim. However, I paid the premium tier, not the premium plus. Not because I care about any of the features it comes with, but because I want to support the company. This world we live in now is that these free things end up costing us a fortune. I like to just be able to pay for something, and then that's our arrangement. Here's this product. Here's my money. Yay! Instead of, here's this free thing. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and we're going to sell all your information or show you ads or whatever. I don't like that. I like it all to be up front. And so far, and this could always change, Ventuski is like that. In the app, you get basically a map. So rather than a report, like, you know, METAR, if you're a pilot, you get a big old map, and it's a visual representation of the weather, and you can make that map show you anything. It will do feels like temperature, precipitation, radar, satellite, clouds, wind speed, wind gusts, air pressure, thunderstorms, humidity, sea level, snow cover, air quality, and other things. I mean, it goes incredibly in depth. It'll show you webcams for the different areas. And if you're doing van life and you're out there, this app is going to give you the best awareness you can possibly have. So I'm looking at the map right now, oddly on a 70-inch screen, so it's pretty big, and I can see that there's a big low pressure zone off the east coast of the US that's south and east of Bermuda, but there's a huge front out there, and it's probably really nasty out in the North Atlantic right now. But here in the Midwest, well, Chicago has some winds coming from the south, and they don't look too severe, but it's something to pay attention to. And there's a little bit of warm weather coming up from the Oklahoma area that's going to give us a day of nice weather. But then after that, there's this big band of cold weather that's coming, and that's worthy of some attention. And so on and so forth. If I click on the thunderstorm links, it'll show me where all the thunder... It's all the data. Now, this thing is powerful, but that also means you need to pay attention and learn how to use it. I do think you're going to want to spend some time figuring out how all this works. And if you're not the kind of person that's interested in actually learning the intricacies of a tool like this, yeah, okay, you can just, you know, ask Alexa or Siri or whatever you have what the weather is and go with that. But if you're somebody who's interested in planning and preparing and thinking, where do I want to be 3 days from now? This is wonderful. Those of you chasing 70 degrees, you know, the idea that you want to be somewhere at 70 degrees all year round, this will be perfect because you can actually see it. And the whole thing's animated. I don't know. If you're a visual person like I am, I'm also an audio person, so whatever. If you're a person, just looking at this will explain it to you. So just go to the website, ventusky.com, ventusky.com, and take a look. Weirdly, and I do not understand this, if you want to pay, you can't do it on the website. You have to do it through the app. And the reason that's weird is because that means on Apple, on iPhones, they're losing 30% of that sale because you have to pay that. That's how it is with Apple. Anything you buy on your iPhone through an app, Apple gets 30%. It's a big bone of contention. It's not that way on Android. I think they get some, but not as much. And normally the way these companies get around this is they direct people to their website and charge them and then activate the app. These guys aren't doing that. And I don't know why. It's really confusing. Side note on that, by the way, if you're going to subscribe to anything like Netflix or whatever and you have an iPhone or an iPad, don't subscribe through the iPhone or the iPad. Go to the website and subscribe. Often the prices are different because they will charge people more through the app because they have to pay Apple more. Just a little side note, somewhat related. I've talked way too much about this thing, but I like it. It's Ventuski or Ventuski, and it is my new weather app. Thank you, Nelly, for the recommendation. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 253. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. I am hard at work on this book. I am determined to have it finished by April, but that doesn't mean it will be available by April. But I am hard at work on it. It is happening, and I hope you like it. Until next time, remember the words of Banana Yoshimoto, who said, "But I have my life. I'm living it. It's twisted, exhausting, uncertain, and full of guilt. But nonetheless, there's something there."